This is Susan Warner, and this is podcast 11 of Susan is Suddenly Single. This podcast is very important, very sensitive, and very difficult for me. We had technical issues recording it, but I think my message is there and understandable. It's too difficult for me to re-record, so I hope you will bear with me, listen, and appreciate my thoughts as I convey to you my journey and my love for my son, David.
This is going to be one of Susan's most difficult podcasts to produce. It's about the death by suicide of her son, David. It's one thing to discuss moving forward after experiencing the death of her son and then her husband, Michael. It's totally another to discuss losing a child. August 18th is the fifth anniversary of her son's death. Talking about David is Susan's way of keeping him close and very much a part of her life. He was a good son, smart, charismatic, kind, and loving. David was 4 weeks from his wedding. Susan's words will probably resonate with all of us on many levels. Life is hard, but Susan's mission is to make it the best possible one for herself and those in her orbit. Thank you, Susan. We really appreciate this.
Understanding. Thank you for letting me talk about David.
Yes.
Important.
But thank you, because you're sharing, and it's important for us, on, as we said, on so many different levels. Understanding that your son David was a suicide, what is the most difficult thing about losing a child? And does it matter how you lose a child?
The most difficult thing about losing a child is losing a child. It is a bodily reaction that I have, and I feel it often about having given life to David. The joy of conceiving him, of carrying him, of giving birth to him, the early years. He is currently, because he's always with me, a part of me physically as well as emotionally and mentally. So with that, unlike any other death I've ever experienced, there is a piece of me gone. I describe it often, it's like a hole in my heart that just won't repair. It's as if someone took an appendage and took it away and you can't get it back. So by talking about David and laughing about David and smiling about David and crying about David, I get to keep him alive and on my shoulder as I move forward. Does it matter how you lose a child? In some way, I think it does. David's suicide was his choice. Very complicated choice, but it is. And possibly there will be people that tell you it's not a choice for those that are a suicide. They only see one way. But not being taken by an illness or an accident, it's probably a little bit easier for me to reconcile the fact that David made this choice. And it wasn't, life is unfair. So marginally, does it matter? Probably not.
Susan, what is the most difficult question people ask you?
Hands down, the single most difficult question I am asked is, how many children do you have? And I stutter and I stop and I think. And my motivation is, I never want to disrespect David because I have two children. I have a son. The fact that he is no longer with me does not diminish the fact that he is my son. And I have a magnificent daughter who I speak to, Elizabeth. If it's someone that I think I'm going to carry on a conversation with and move forward with information, at some point I will talk about my 31-year-old daughter and I lost my son. If it's pertinent and they continue to ask, I will say I lost my son to suicide and we will continue. But I feel very strongly that I don't want to disrespect David's life, and I want to carry on his memory.
I have heard you say suicide is selfless, not selfish. What do you mean by that?
That's probably one of the most important things that I can put out there, that people who are suicides are not doing it to hurt other people. They're not to hurt other lives. They're doing it because they believe that you life will be better without them. They're trying to make it easier on those left behind. Oftentimes they feel unworthy. They feel that they're not deserving of the love and the understanding and the emotion that is emitted towards them. They do this to try to make those that survived their lives easier. It is not to make it more difficult. And I can't stress that enough when people say, I've had people write me notes and it's, David, did you not realize how much you were loved and how hurt we are? It's not about, it's about the pain that he was in and that suicides are in. It's the burning building theory. If you stand on a balcony of a building, do you go back into the flame or do you jump? Jumping gives you some hope. Going back into the building is reliving your demons or going back into the fire. Jumping gives you the hope of ending up on the other side. So I can't stress enough that it is a self act, not a selfish act. And those that are suicide should not be looked at that, oh, you hurt me. Why did you do this to me? They did it to you. They did it to them to make try to make your life easier or better because they felt worthy. And that
made my understanding better.
They made my understanding easier.
When did you figure that out?
I've done reading a lot, and there are several doctors who have written about this theory. Some theories go the other way. I mean, there are theories that I don't subscribe to. There was one theory about people who jump off bridges. They did a study and lived. He said, regretted the act. I don't know that I believe that. So I've done reading. Do I absorb what for me? Of course, don't we all? Of course, we all have this set of preconceived ideas that we subscribe to that substantiate what we believe. But I've read about a lot of psychology in suicide. And I think you, David, so well, as he was charismatic and gregarious and kind, loving, he suffered from low self-esteem, and I know that in my heart. Thought that he was making life for us. So it's backed up with studies and my own personal feelings.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. Exactly what happened to David? Tell us about him.
David, as I said, was bigger than life. He filled up a whole room when he walked. Charisma and kindness and love is rarely seen in a person. He suffered from addiction, gambling, probably the worst of that. They say that there's a heredity factor, and there is play in my family that would relate to heredity. He did get involved in drug abuse, but the overarching problem was gambling addiction, and that is a horrible addiction because you can't see it in their eyes or smell it on their breath. He'd call me Bear and say, Bear, I'm clean. I'm not gambling. I'm good. And I knew he was gambling. And that the advent of online gambling, it made it much worse. The ability to sneak and do it without people seeing it, without calling a bookie, without having a trace was overwhelming. And with these addictions and these demons, I think never saw the future as being able to give it up. He went to rehab. He was in therapy. His therapist was shocked when he died. He was very good at deceiving people. He was so happy. If you'd look at 100 pictures of David, you'd see his smile stand out. He had the most beautiful smile, and it was always the most overwhelming thing people saw when he was in person and in pictures. So everybody was so confused. Well, we understand demons better than anybody else. Mm-hmm. They weren't completely a surprise. David had flirted with ideas of life will be better without me, Mom. And the one comment I always made to him was, David, I love you too much. The only way you'll ever hurt me is if you leave me. And I said that for years prior to his death. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough.
So were there signs, and did you like always suspect that it could happen, or you didn't really, it really wasn't in the realm of possibility?
I don't think we ever really thought it was going to happen, and I don't think we ever really spoke about it, but obviously I had some sort of fear if my comment to him is, the only way you'll ever hurt me is if you leave me. Mm-hmm. My daughter did comment after David's death that she was always waiting for the phone call, whether it was going to be drugs or something else. As much as she was as shocked as all of us and as hurt as all of us, there was some element that it wasn't a total surprise, that there was some sort of feeling with him not understanding the consequences, and that at some point something was going to go to the left. So did we expect it? No. Were we shocked and horrified and devastated and shattered? Yes. Was there an inkling of a possibility, maybe somewhere back in the recesses of our minds? Yes. We always, you know, when we didn't talk to him one day, Michael and I would look at each other and say, speak to David today. So yes, we were always worried, always worried. Mm. He worked with Michael for the last year before he died. And Michael once said to me, every morning I'd go by his office, and if he was late or he wasn't there, I'd hold my breath. So yes, there was always a fear of some sort of destructive behavior. Probably more we were afraid of drugs than we were of suicide, but it was definitely a small nagging that we were always worried for his safety. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you go into the true sense of shock, or how did you stabilize yourself? Because when you hear something like that, whether you expected it or not, it's, you know, it's devastation.
Yes. We found out in the middle of the night. Oddly, I was out east. Michael was in the city. He definitely bore the brunt because he had to go. I was here. I couldn't. He left us a note, which we both, an email, which we both had, which was a beautiful email, very kind and loving. It was surreal. But to tell you the truth, if I played it back now, I'm not even sure I could put the order, I could sequence what happened. Michael and I being at a distance was nightmaric. I did call my brothers-in-law, who rushed to Michael's side and helped him so much, so unselfish and kind. I called my sister-in-law here in the Hamptons, and at 4 in the morning ran to me. Everybody was so kind and so supportive, but I can't even sequence the events for you, honestly. Mm-hmm. It was all very surreal and very cloudy. Now, shock and pain and lack of believing, you know, Michael and I would say at some point, maybe it's not true. Maybe he just disappeared from gambling debts for a while and he's going to come back.
Right.
Of course, we knew that wasn't true. His body was recovered. David jumped. So his body was recovered. So we knew it, but we would say, maybe he's going to come back to us. You know, like he just disappeared. You know, we would look at each other in ridiculous hope, knowing it wasn't true, but hoping against hope it was.
Were you and Michael kind of in agreement about all your feelings and everything you're explaining now, or, you know, your reaction, you know, your thoughts about him? Was it in sync?
You know, people have to play roles when things like this happen. Elizabeth and I were better at intellectualizing David's pain and understanding why he couldn't stay with us. Michael, as his father, was completely destroyed. Michael said to us on several occasions, I wish I could think like you and Elizabeth. I wish I could say he's in a better place. I wish I could say he couldn't cope with these demons. Michael felt a responsibility that was totally wrong. I mean, you know, no one could love him more or take care of him more. He couldn't get past the physicality of losing his son. It aged him. It destroyed him. He took personal responsibility. I think in this case, I was more of the rock, and Michael leaned more on me to make this right, which I had no problem with. Many times, if a song came on that he and David liked together, he would cry. Many times out in the Hamptons, tears would just come down his face. He just could not reconcile the death of his son. And that's why in Michael's death, 6 months after David's, I often think that souls travel in pairs and that Michael had to go to David to take care of him. And I've said this before, that if Michael believed that I would take care of Elizabeth and we would be okay together, as much as he loved us equally, he knew that he had to go to his son to make sure he was all right in heaven. And my vision of them now is together, laughing, eating steak, having a shot of vodka, making jokes, loving each other. And that's very comforting in my mind's eye.
Well put. So having said all that, what does your inner voice, you know, what is your inner voice saying?
You mean, is it saying sometimes, how did this happen to me?
Right.
That's not the overwhelming thing I feel. I think that honestly, and I said this from the onset, my inner voice is saying that I had 32 years of the most incredible son. Love and laughter and kindness and care and protectiveness, that a lot of people don't get that fulfillment. So was I cut short? Yes. But I had 32 years of this extraordinary, larger-than-life boy to man who made me a very happy mother and a very proud mother. So aren't I the lucky one on that level?
Good for you. That's great to hear.
It works for me, Lois. It works.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah. How, you know, I'm curious also, how did your friends and family react?
After the shock, and it was completely shocking to everyone else, because I have to say, as a family unit, we kept our problems to ourselves. Right or wrong, we kept our problems to ourselves. And that's such an interesting point, because as I have widowed and then losing a child, or losing a child and widowed, I have a clearer vision on other people's family lives and marriages and things, and I see that everybody has their problems. More so than when I was in my own unit, that I was watching myself more than looking outward. I don't say poor me. I can't, because everybody has pain. Everybody deals with stuff. As I've said to you before, if I'm being tested, I want the test to stop. I'm done. I think I've endured enough. But things happen, and they're out of my control. And my attitude is, take that love, take who he was, and move forward. So my friends and family have been very wonderful at the same thing. Shock was initial. Everybody wanted to run to help. Everybody had the stories. We had a private funeral graveside for David and a memorial service, I think a week after, I don't even know. I think there were 800 people at his memorial service. Mm-hmm. It was so magnificent. It's all a blur. And people say to me, do you remember seeing so-and-so? No, I don't. It was all a blur. But the outpouring of love, the amount of young women who wrote to me about their relationships with David, and I didn't even know who they were, and how he changed their life, or he helped them in a way that no one else could help them, or he had 10 best friends. One of his best friends is having another one of David's best friends as his best man as an homage to David. It was such an outpouring of love. David, for his groomsman gift, got high top Keds that they were supposed to change into with their initials on it and the date of the wedding. One of his best friends wore those to his own wedding as an honor to David.
Oh my God.
So the outpouring, and to this day, my family and friends still talk about David. No one cloaks it. No one whispers. Everyone wants to talk about David and bring him up and share him. And that is such a gift to me, because I only want to share David. I don't want him to disappear in people's memories. I want him to stay alive. And they have been exemplary and extraordinary. My nephew got married this weekend, and my brother started his speech with, you know, we miss David and Michael here. Hmm. And hurt, yes. Love, yes. Gratitude, yes. So
Wow. Beyond
incredible. Yeah.
All I could say was right. Wow.
I don't know what I did to deserve this, Lois, but my friends and family have been my foundation and my support and supplied me with more than anyone can ask, as well as my extraordinary daughter and son-in-law, who now I have to tell you, I must mention this, that going from two children to one children is very hard. But because of the advent of Elizabeth marrying Pat and bringing him into my life, I am now able to say my children again. And those are the best phrase I could ever re-say, because now I have two children again, and it feels really good. And I use it a lot in reference to them, my children.
Whew, I have to go, whew. I hate to go back to the next question, but because, you know, you're saying so many positive things, and I feel like you are teaching the world, you know, like we kind of like are looking into a window that many of us have never looked before and heard things we never heard before, and you're teaching us things, a way to look at life that is very positive. So it's amazing the words that you have been using, and now, you know, I there's more stuff like, you know, to rehash about, but I hate doing it because you opened up a whole new world to so many of us. So again, I want to say thank you to you. But
thank
what
you.
Did you and Michael and Elizabeth say to each other when you first heard about this? I mean, what were the words that you used to each other to comfort each other, to support each other, you know, to be alive?
I'll be honest with you, I don't remember. I really don't remember. I know that, as I said, Elizabeth and I intellectualized a lot. You know, how long could David do this? Did he see a future? David never talked about the future. Like, he was extraordinarily with his little cousins. He was the oldest cousin. Yet, and he loved children. Great camp counselor, unbelievable with little ones. But I never heard him talk about his own. I almost think he was incapable of looking into the future. So with Elizabeth, it was an intellectuality about death and David being in a better place, not being able to put up with this pain. With Michael, it was most loving him. The question often comes, did this drive a wedge between you and Michael? It did the opposite for us. It brought us closer. It brought us to a level, if that was possible, it brought us to a level of love and understanding and joined heart that was a new level of being. So for us, we were lucky that it brought us closer together. It did not at all drive us apart. And the same with Elizabeth. She's very conscious. She takes care. She's very conscious, you know, of forcing my independence. But her concern for me is magnificent and deep.
Mm-hmm.
Deep. And I think it's gotten even deeper with losing a brother and her father.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's beautiful in itself. Who was the one that was least hysterical and supported the group with calming and rational words?
Again, so much of it is a blur, and so many people picked up pieces from my brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law that stayed with Michael in the city and helped identify David, to my sister-in-law, Angie, being out here with me from the second it happened. I can't identify a singular person or persons.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a village. It is so true. And it took a village. I have another friend, Doris, who really helped us with all the arrangements and like took control. And that was incredible because we weren't capable. And everybody powwowed in and never, ever infringed on anything. So it was really a takes a village. My whole family and my friend group just rushed in. I can't identify a singular answer to that.
Well, the answer is you were very fortunate.
Yes, and I know that. And, you know, I know with other people's pain and other people's issues that they might not have the same familial or friend structure that I do.
Mm-hmm.
And that I understand, do. In that case, people might shake and say, well, look how fortunate she is. And I recognize every moment of how fortunate I am. I do, every moment. It was a very long relationship with my friends and a very deep relationship with my sisters-in-law and brothers that built this, and it still maintains. We're still a very strong group. So I can't tell you that I don't understand depth of how fortunate I am.
Mm-hmm.
And if other people don't have that, I understand that, and I'm not sure I can tell them how to maneuver, but for me, it was my lifeline.
Powerful words, that's all I could say. How did you function after the days of David's death? I'm curious about, you know, maybe it's a blur too. Maybe it's a silly question, but like, I can't imagine what you were thinking.
A lot of it was a blur. And I know we tried to do things that were normal. We tried to go to SoulCycle. And I've explained this previously, where those people picked up and their community just completely cocooned us and made us comfortable and let us do the mental mechanisms that I talked about, walk it out, talk it out, think it out. They let us walk it out. They let us involve in the music and the exercise and be there without any stigma and without any hassle. You know, in Judaism, you bury quickly and the Shiva process starts very fast. So that, you know, was quick. And also the religious aspect of the synagogue and the cemetery that rushed to my aid out here in the Hamptons, Ladakh, was beyond the call of duty or extraordinary. They rushed in and completely took over for me, unlike any experience I've ever had. And for that, I am eternally grateful and support the synagogue out here. Coincidentally, that I married Pat and Elizabeth a year ago by sheer coincidence. Mm. And they've become a piece of us. So we went from burial to Shiva, you know, to then trying to resume life. I pushed my husband and my daughter back to work, after Shiva, trying to maintain some normalcy, and that worked. Just sort of to move through the motions of life. And it worked. We did.
You had to feel like, or I shouldn't say you had to, but did you feel like you were on the outside looking in?
Often in my life, I feel like I'm on the outside looking in. Mm-hmm. You know, up until addictions and some habits, it was charmed. I led a charmed life, you know, madly in love with my husband, wonderful, wonderful marriage, two beautiful children, incredible family. It was a charmed life. So then all of a sudden, when everything kept crashing down, I sometimes felt that I was sitting on my own shoulder. Sometimes I still feel like I'm sitting on my own shoulder, sometimes in a positive way. I'm like, did I really do that? Have I really become her, positive and negative? But I feel that I could do things in the third person with me sometimes, yes. Sometimes I look back and say, 5 years? That's not possible. Time marches on, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, is that mm-hmm. how you rationalized it?
As I said, I rationalized it because David's life was so hard for David and his demons were so difficult that in his eyes, this was a better way. I can't imagine David having a lifetime of this pain. Mm-hmm. So I rationalize it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you feel that you could cope for the immediate future and a long-term basis? What was going through your head?
I am that person, Lois. I cope. It's my DNA. So yes, I was going to embrace my husband, embrace my orbit, and I was going to cope. And that's what I did. I never, ever have wanted to not be here, to not live life, to not have more. That's never been in my DNA.
So how did you present yourself at first? Did you want sympathy or did you want to be left alone? Who were you?
Who am I? you know, it's funny. Elizabeth and I have had a conversation that because we are perceived to be so well adjusted, people forget what we've been through. And I've had people say to me that have had a loss, you know, I've endured the most. And I've looked at them sometimes and said, really? Like, do you really forget where I come from? Mm-hmm. But that's not fair. And again, as I've said in the past, I will never judge anybody's grief. I will never judge anybody's loss because the loss of your 92-year-old mother could be super devastating and rock your world as my losses have been for me. So I don't. Coping is coping. It is. But I do think sometimes that people forget where Elizabeth and I come from. And sometimes take a step back and say, we got to cut him a break. You know, perception is reality, but not always.
So you basically, yeah, right. So you and Elizabeth changed in your thinking because of this experience.
Yes.
Hmm. How has this impacted your relationship with Elizabeth?
I don't think that too much has changed. We are very close, very similar people. With the man I'm with right now, after spending time in the Hamptons with me and Elizabeth, he'd say, wow, you two are really alike. You know, I think that sometimes we don't cut each other a break. Sometimes we do. I think that we are who we are, and it is us. I'm closer, but I don't know if that's possible. We have a really extraordinary relationship with its ups and downs. Don't get but we have an extraordinary relationship of respect and love, deep care and commitment.
Well, all I could say to that is you're very fortunate again. You're so fortunate in so many ways that thank you, for sharing this. But if you could, what would you have done differently in this whole journey of recent years?
When I say out loud to people, my close friends, my family, my daughter, that I should have done X, particularly Elizabeth, who is so kind and sincere about this, she looks at me and she says, really? So when David was floundering at Michigan, University of Michigan, I should not have helped him. And she looked at me and said, what? And I said, I'll pull him out. And she said, what? So you would have pulled him out and put him in a situation that might have been worse? She's very, very rational about I did, and Michael and I did all we could, and that some things are beyond our control. I do believe that David's addiction, his entire persona were chemical, that he was wired differently, and that there were things that no matter what I did, I couldn't change him. So when I try to think of something, she really pulls me back in a very loving and kind way and says, don't do that, Mom. And when I'm floundering on Mother's Day, she says to me, stop. As does often my brother. Stop. You loved them unconditionally. You gave them what you thought was right. You did everything. There's no manual to parenthood. And I couldn't change David as a persona. So could I really do anything differently? I don't think so. I don't think so. But I do go through the gamut of emotions that I should have, could have, would have.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I'm fortunate to have people like Elizabeth who basically pulls me back and says, don't do that. You are an incredible mother. Don't do that. So that really helps a lot, a lot.
So you have taken us down quite a journey. And our last question for you, so the other podcasts, of course, will go on to cover a lot of this, but after you've just put us on, or we shared this emotional journey with you, and if those are not the proper words, excuse me, but...
No, I think they are.
Yeah. Do you fantasize about the future, and how has it shifted from what was and what is?
Doesn't everyone? Don't we all fantasize the future before my losses? As I said, Michael and I were walking down the sunset, growing old together. I was going to, hopefully one day see my children married and successful, a house full of grandchildren, et cetera, et cetera. So we all fantasize, I think. Has my fantasy changed? I don't think so. I mean, I'm not that person in totality, but as I've said repeatedly, I want to love. I want to be loved. I want to be known to give. I want to be successful in my relationships and my work. I want to tell my story and share it with success. I want my family to expand, and I want them to be healthy and happy.
Beautiful. And let's end it there. Thank you, Susan, very, very much. This was very enlightening. It was very real. We're very fortunate to have you to share this all with you. And thank you.
Thank you, Lois.